Hello, everyone. Greetings from Washington, D.C. I know that you are tuned in to hear all about this evidence-based synthesis report and therefore wondering why the Office of Health Equity is in the middle of it. The simple answer is that the topic was nominated by the Office of Health Equity, and your next question is probably why, and I will attempt to answer that as well. But first, I will share with you some background in relation to health equity. On slide number two, this is just a quick outline of what you can expect. We will have a quick intro about Office of Health Equity, and then I'll answer the why question. After that, Dr. Jennifer Gerish will give you the details of the ESD on this topic, disparities in quality indicators among adults with mental illness, a systematic review. Finally, we will have time for questions and answers. Just a few definitions on slide three to put things in perspective. Health equity is the attainment of the highest level of health for all, and health disparities, which are the result of the absence of health equity, is a particular type of health difference that is closely linked to social or economic disadvantage. And then I included the National Quality Forum definition for social demographic factors, as you see on the last bullet. Moving on to slide number four, health disparities tend to adversely affect groups of people shown on this slide. These are groups that have experienced social or economic obstacles over time, and these are often unintended obstacles. Being a member of any of these categories poses challenges for attaining the highest level of health. These are the categories which the Office of Health Equity and, of course, the Veterans Health Administration refers to as vulnerable populations. They fall under racial, ethnic, gender, military era and service, geography, sexual orientation, religion, age, socioeconomic status, disability, and mental health. I mentioned mental health last, not because it is the least, but rather to draw your attention to that and the connection to this cyber seminar topic, and therefore the Office of Health Equity. So moving on to slide number five, this slide is an effort to share with you excerpts from the Veterans Health Administration Health Equity Action Plan, which was deployed by the Office of Health Equity and the VA Health Equity Coalition to guide the VA journey towards health equity for all veterans, especially the most vulnerable, as we have just reviewed in the prior slide. Everyone has a role to play in that journey, and as you can see, research, data, and evaluation is a key area. This ESD aligns with that. This cyber seminar also aligns with the awareness goals. The Office of Health Equity looks forward to partnering and collaborating with all of you and your organizations to advance health equity. The details of the Health Equity Action Plan, including a video of my dialogue with the Interim Undersecretary for Health, Dr. Carolyn Clancy, with her endorsement of the Health Equity Action Plan, can be accessed on the Office of Health Equity intranet site. Unfortunately, the Office of Health Equity does not at this time have an internet site, but these documents can only be accessed within VHA firewalls. However, I encourage all of you with VA access to look up the folder and review the Health Equity Action Plan. Identify your piece of that pie. And my key question remains, what can you do today in your area of influence to positively impact health equity? Moving to slide number six, this is a snapshot of one of the documents you can view in that folder, a crosswalk of the Health Equity Action Plan with the VA Strategic Plan, the Veterans Health Administration Strategic Plan, the Veterans Health Administration Blueprint for Excellence, and the National Partnership for Action Recommendations for Tackling Health Disparities. I will not dwell on this particular slide, but I welcome you to cross-reference these documents as you think about what you can contribute to advancing health equity. Slide number seven. This is titled the VHA Blueprint for Excellence. This slide is intended to draw your attention to the specific elements of the VHA Blueprint for Excellence that are directly related to health equity. strategy number two, Transformation Action 2.2A, is shown, DHA will aspire to the triple aim, better health care and value, and focus performance measurement on strategic outcomes. Also, strategy number three, Transformation Action 3.2A, implement a population health program. Again, drawing your attention to vulnerable populations as we think about population health programs. And then strategy number seven, Transformation Action 7.2B, advanced knowledge on improving individual and population health. There are other strategies of interest that also impact health equity, including personalized patient plan, partnerships for data, and many others. But I am singling out one more that should be of interest to this cyber seminar audience. On strategy number seven, there's 7.2H transformational action. Rapidly translate research and evidence-based treatments into clinical practice. In the spirit of the VHA Blueprint for Excellence, the current cycle of the Quality Enhancement Research and Implementation Query Request for Proposals includes a call for health equity themed quality improvement projects to address health disparities at a vision and facility levels. I look forward to seeing all of you take advantage of that opportunity to make a difference in vulnerable populations. The Office of Health Equity will partner with Query to fund appropriate projects through this effort. Now on slide number eight, this is where you get to participate, at least in this cyber seminar, and Molly will guide us through that. Molly?
Thank you. So what's on your screen now is a situational premise to the poll question that we will put up in just a moment. So a veteran who served in Vietnam is receiving treatment at a rural VA outreach clinic for management of chronic medical and mental health diagnoses. So at this time, you'll see up on your screen the interactive poll page. And the question is, in how many domains is she vulnerable for health and or healthcare disparity? So please just click the circle next to your answer. And again, the premise was a veteran who served in Vietnam is receiving treatment at a rural VA outreach clinic for management of chronic medical and mental health diagnoses. And it looks like just about half of our audience has voted, but more answers are streaming in, so we'll give people more time to respond. And these are anonymous responses, so no one will be penalized for making a wrong guess. We will not be grading these, I promise. Okay, well, it looks like we've had about 80% of our audience vote, so that's pretty good. So I'm going to go ahead and close the poll now, and I'll share those results and talk through them. So it looks like we have 2% that reported 2, 33% said 3, and 65% said 4 or more. So thank you to those respondents. And Dr. Girish, I'm going to turn it back over to you now, so you should see that pop up again. Excellent.
Well, thank you so much, Molly, for walking us through that. It looks like Ask the Audience was a popular answer here. And, yes, it was four or more. There was a little trick in there with in asking the question as far as she. So that might be what the 33% may have not picked up, that there was gender. So the domains were military era Vietnam, geography rural, mental health, as already mentioned, and then gender, female. So thank you for participating. Finally, the last two slides for my portion of the presentation are the why slides. Why did we focus on mental health? The burden of disease on veterans and the VA is one answer. The burden is on both mental and physical health, and mental health is a vulnerable characteristic for health disparities, as we have just explored. And the other question is why Office of Health Equity and why the ESP? The findings, we hope, stand to inform policy and future research. It is part of the Office of Health Equity effort to identify where health and healthcare disparities exist, do our best to understand the reasons why, and take necessary actions to address them. Office of Health Equity therefore partnered with the Evidence-Based Synthesis Program, and the work of the Durham ESB Center was a systematic review of health disparities in quality indicators of healthcare among adults with mental illness. The ESB assessed if and to what extent disparities in healthcare exist for individuals with mental illness in the VA. At this time, I will turn you over to Dr. Jennifer Gerrish to tell you all about the ESB. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that excellent introduction and framing of the question and why Office of Health Equity would be interested in this topic. As we said, the topic we'll be discussing today is a systematic review of the evidence of disparities in healthcare quality indicators among adults with mental illness. I first want to acknowledge my co-authors, of which there were many. One of the great things about the Evidence Synthesis Program is that many people volunteer their time to work on topics that are near and dear to their heart. And we also allow trainees and students to come in and help us too. So we had four students help us on this project, which was really great. And then wanted to give a special acknowledgement to Christopher Beatles, who was a lead investigator on this study. I also want to acknowledge our expert panel and reviewers that came from the Office of Health Equity, Mental Health Services, and Patient Care Services. Just want to state that I have, these are my opinions and not the opinions of the VA that are being expressed today, and that I have, nor do any of my co-investigators have any conflicts to disclose here. Just a little bit about the Evidence-Based Synthesis Program. It's sponsored by the VA Office of R&D and the Query. It's established to provide timely and accurate syntheses, reviews of important healthcare topics. These topics are identified by clinicians, managers, and policymakers. And it builds on staff expertise already in place at these EPC centers that are ARC-funded. In fact, there are four ESP centers across the VA. Durham is just one of the sites. Greater Los Angeles is another site, Portland is another site, and Minneapolis is the last site. We provide evidence synthesis on important clinical practice topics, and these are coordinated through the ESP Coordinating Center. And if you have an important clinical or policy question, I encourage you to nominate that topic throughout our process, and you can access any of these hyperlinks in this talk to get to examples of reports from past years and also to get to the nomination forms. This next slide gives you a little bit of feedback on who our technical expert panels are and our external peer reviewers. Each report is rigorously peer reviewed, and each report also has a technical expert panel that advises us along the way on questions, methodological and content expertise questions. And then lastly, final reports are posted to the VA HSR website. Usually those are embargoed just for VA use if the principal investigator wants for, 6 months or so. And we disseminate these widely through cyber seminars such as the one you're attending today and policy briefs to upper management. So I, too, have a poll question for you all. I just wanted to get an idea of who is around the virtual table today. And so I'll turn this back over to Molly to help with that.
Thank you. So as our attendees can see, you do have that second poll question up on your screen at this time. And we're asking, what is your primary role in VA? We understand that many of you probably have multiple roles, so we're looking for what you spend the majority of your time doing. And those answer options are student, trainee, or fellow, clinician, researcher, or policymaker, or other. And just in case you don't see your particular job title on this list. At the end, when we have our feedback survey, there will be a more extensive list of positions, and you may find yours there, so please stick around to fill that out. Okay, it looks like we've had 83% of our audience respond, so that's great. I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share the results now. Jennifer, can you see those? You may not be able to.
I can.
Okay.
No, I can.
Would you like to talk through them real quick?
So it's interesting. We have a vast majority of folks self-identify as their primary role is in research. So that's very exciting. As you'll see, I think there's multiple opportunities for advanced research on this topic. And as things come up, please be jotting down your research ideas for studies that you think could be done on this topic. And I'm happy to talk with anyone about that because I have lots of ideas as well. I'm also excited to see that there, you know, 11% of folks here are managers or policymakers because that is an audience that we hope to reach. And again, really happy to see that there's a good mix of clinicians and trainees on the phone too. Because that allows us to sort of influence the sort of rubber meets the road folks. And now it looks like I have to show my screen again. All right, excellent. And with that, I'm going to actually launch into the meat of the of our systematic review today. We had the Office of Health Equity talked about why they were interested in this, and I think it's a really an important topic for them to address because mental health is a key disparity in the VA and outside the VA. However, assessing healthcare quality is complex and incredibly challenging. And there are a multitude of approaches that one can take when trying to assess healthcare quality. The approach that we took for this particular report was in concert with our partners at the Office of Health Equity and our technical expert panel. We used this idea of tracer conditions and tracer preventive services to serve as sort of barometers or indicators of overall healthcare quality. For something to be a tracer condition or service, it had to be a prevalent condition, and there had to be strong evidence and agreement on the appropriate care and goals of the therapy. With that in mind, we developed two key questions that are on your screen now. Among adult patients, are there health disparities for those with mental illness compared to those without mental illness in the following areas? We focused on receipt of appropriate preventive care services and indicated screenings, and then management of key chronic medical conditions. And then for key question number two, we were really looking at do any of these vary, these effects vary by key moderators of interest. Again, those moderators of interest were developed in concert with our technical expert panel and the interests of the Office of Health Equity. So this is our analytic framework. Let me just talk you through this a little bit, and the red text highlights the areas that I will be highlighting specifically. Over in the populations box, you can see that these had to be comparative studies, and so we are interested in studies that had populations that compared patients with and without mental health diagnoses. For the chronic medical illness conditions, we are specifically interested in diabetes, hypertension, or ischemic heart disease. The interventions, per se, of interest were preventive care services, were age-appropriate cancer screenings, focusing on breast, colorectal, and cervical cancer screenings, screening and referral for tobacco use, and age-appropriate immunizations, focusing on pneumococcal and influenza vaccination. Again, for chronic disease management, we focused on diabetes care. Within that, we focused on key process of care indicators such as HbA1c testing, LDL-C at goal, eye exams, nephropathy screening, diabetic foot exams, and blood pressure. For hypertension, we focused on blood pressure being adequately controlled and proportionate goal. And for ischemic heart disease, we looked at key prescribing patterns and proportionate blood pressure at goal and cardiac cath rate. Chiefly related to key question two, we looked at modifying factors based on patient characteristics, which is this dashed oval at the top. Specifically, we were interested in veteran status, socio-demographic differences defined as race, ethnicity, gender or sex, and sexual orientation. We also were interested in illness type and severity, focused on the mental health illness and severity. Under modifying factors for setting, we were also interested in looking at the literature and seeing if we could find any moderator or effect moderator analyses by location of care, whether someone, for example, receives care in a family medicine versus OBGYN or VA versus non-VA, and also the geographic location of that care. And with that, we'll launch into our methods. This is an overview of our study eligibility. We required that for the folks in the studies that had mental health diagnosis, we required that that was confirmed by a clinical diagnosis or chart diagnosis, an administrative code, or research diagnosis. We specifically focused on diagnoses of bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, MDD or broad spectrum depressive disorders, or post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. I already spoke briefly about the interventions that we were interested. These had to be comparative studies. That is, we excluded studies that only took population controls. For settings, we restricted our inclusion criteria to include studies only conducted in the U.S., and we wanted studies conducted only in non-mental health outpatient primary care settings and selected specialty settings. And we also required that study samples be within 100 subjects or more. We developed our search strategy in consultation with two experienced librarians, and we conducted a primary search in PubMed, the Cochrane Library, Embase, and PsycINFO. We bounded our search strategy from 1994 to 2004. We restricted the search to articles published from 1994 forward due to the limited use of performance measures prior to the mid-1990s. Let's talk a little bit about how we approach data synthesis. We summarized key features of the included studies from the abstracted data. We determined the feasibility of completing quantitative synthesis or meta-analysis to estimate summary effects. Feasibility depended on the volume of the relevant literature, conceptual homogeneity of the studies, and completeness of the reporting of results. We performed meta-analysis only when there were at least three studies with the same outcome, based on the rationale that fewer studies do not provide adequate evidence for summary effects. We also took into consideration the conceptual homogeneity of the mental health conditions assessed, and only pooled studies where it made sense to pool across particular populations. We calculated summary odds ratios, and we used random effects models with a particular type of correction to correct for small numbers of studies across comparisons. We evaluated statistic heterogeneity two ways, with the Cochrane's Q and the I-squared statistic. If the I-squared statistic was 75 or above, we reported forest plots without summary estimates. I-squareds over 75% are considered to have high heterogeneity, and we thought it best that we just present forest plots so people could visually get an idea, and we will talk about the ranges and medians of those results. When we were unable to conduct quantitative synthesis, we did qualitative synthesis, where we gave more weight to higher quality studies, and then we analyzed potential reasons for inconsistencies and effects across the different studies, including differences in the way the populations were gathered, the interventions, the comparators, and definitions of the outcomes. And with that, let's just launch into some results of our literature search and study characteristics. We screened nearly 4,000 citations that yielded 310 full-text reviews. When we rigorously applied our inclusion and exclusion criteria, we found 26 reports that encompassed 23 unique studies. We found 7 studies that looked at cancer screening, 3 that looked at receipt of immunizations, to only 2 that looked at screening, tobacco use, and referral. For the management of those 3 key chronic disease conditions, the majority of the studies we found were related to diabetes, only 2 for hypertension, and 1 for ischemic heart disease. The study designs were predominantly cross-sectional, with followed very closely by retrospective cohort, and then only two prospective cohort. I think something that we should be very proud of is that the majority of studies were conducted within the VA healthcare system, and that is a credit to the huge wealth of data that we have, and also I think the interest of VA investigators, clinicians, and policymakers on the effects of mental health on uptake of quality indicators of health care. Let's launch into the results of the cancer screening. Overall, we identified 7 studies that compared cancer screening rates for those with mental illness and those without. Across those studies, 4 were compared composite mental illnesses. That is, they took a population that had a broad range of mental illnesses and compared it to folks who did not have a mental health diagnosis. And then 3 were among folks that had depressive disorders compared to those that did not have a depressive disorder. And 3 of these studies were conducted with VA users. We'll launch first into the mammography screening results. We had sufficient studies to look at mammography screening specifically among folks with depressive disorders. However, heterogeneity was high when we pooled these results, and so I'll just be presenting the forest plot without a summary estimate. All studies, as you can see from the forest plot, everything's on the left-hand side, so found a negative relationship between receipt of mammography and depressive disorders, and the odds ratios range from 0.48 to 0.90. We also identified 2 additional studies that looked at broadly defined mental illness groups compared to those with without mental illness. Across those 2 studies, results were mixed. Though both of these studies, the first one was a cross-sectional study using EPRP data from the VA from 1999, and it found a negative and significant relationship between mammography screening and having a mental health diagnosis. The next one was just conducted within a statewide VA healthcare system database, and it found a negative but not statistically significant effect, and in fact the confidence interval was quite wide on that one. Next, we'll look at cervical cancer screening. Again, we had sufficient studies to look at PAP testing and depressive disorders. For this, we were able to pool 3 studies, and the summary estimate displayed low heterogeneity. That is, the I-squared was only 6.3%, which is fantastically low, and the odds ratio is 0.78, which means that folks with depressive disorders were significantly less likely to receive PAP smears compared to those without a mental health diagnosis. Next, we identified 2 additional studies that looked at broadly defined mental illnesses compared to those without mental illness. Again, it's the same 2 data sets, the EPRP data set and this Mexico VA healthcare system. And again, the results were flipped. The EPRP data, which was a national data set, found a negative and significant relationship. But the New Mexico VA healthcare system database found an effect size that trended positively but was incredibly imprecise. Next, let's look at the results for colorectal cancer screening. We had sufficient studies to look at, to pool studies for colorectal cancer screening and depressive disorders. Yet again, the heterogeneity was high. All studies found a negative relationship, and our odds ratios ranged from 0.43 to 0.9. We also found a few other studies that looked at broadly defined mental illness. 3 additional studies, and results were mixed. 2 were found positive and significant results, and 1 found a non-significant result. We found 1 additional study that looked at psychotic disorders and the relationship between receiving colorectal cancer screenings. And this study found a significant and negative association between having a psychotic disorder and receipt of colorectal cancer screening. And lastly, we found one additional study that allowed us to look at the effects of PTSD on CRC screening. This study found a negative association that was not significant. So just to sort of sum up what we found across the seven studies, we had adequate studies to conduct three meta-analyses. However, all but one pooled analysis had displayed high variability or heterogeneity. Nearly all studies displayed a similar pattern of negative associations, but not all of those comparisons were statistically significant. And we only had three studies that assessed cancer screening among VA users with and without mental illness. Yet when you compare those studies conducted in the VA to those studies conducted outside the VA, we found a similar pattern of negative associations between having a mental health diagnosis and receipt of evidence-based cancer screening recommendations. This suggests small to moderate disparities in cancer screening for people with mental illness. Next, we'll take a moment to talk about the results we found on immunization. Overall, the evidence was incredibly limited. We only identified three comparative studies, and results were mixed, and we found no evidence of large disparities reported across these studies. For influenza, we really found one study found no evidence to support disparities in receipt of this vaccination, and another study found no significant differences in self-reported receipt of this vaccination. For pneumococcal vaccinations, we found one VA study reported that patients with psychiatric diagnoses had a lower probability of receiving this than patients without this diagnosis. And then we found one VA study reporting that those with depression were no less likely to receive a pneumococcal vaccination than those without depression. Next, let's move on to screening and referral for tobacco use. Again, it was surprising that we have found limited comparative evidence. We only found two cross-sectional studies, both with VA users. The first study was among those with mental found that those with mental illness are more likely to be screened for tobacco use and referred for counseling, which is encouraging. However, study two found quite a mixed bag when they teased apart this group of folks with mental illness. Study two found that smokers with PTSD and depressive disorders were more likely to receive a physician's recommendation for smoking cessation medications. However, smokers with schizophrenia were less likely to receive advice to quit from physicians. And for folks with bipolar disorder, this study found no differences for smokers with a diagnosis of a bipolar disorder compared to those without a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. And with that, we're going to move on to our disease management, our chronic disease management questions, of which we found the bulk of the information around diabetes. We identified 16 papers encompassing 14 studies that compared diabetes process of care outcomes among those with and without mental illness. Interestingly, most of the studies were relatively recent, conducted from 2002 to 2012, and the mental health diagnoses that were encompassed in those 14 studies were seven that looked at composite or broadly defined mental illness groups, six that gave us estimates separate for folks with serious mental illness, five for folks with depressive disorders, and only one for PTSD. Again, half the studies were conducted with VA users. We'll launch into HbA1c testing first. We had sufficient studies to conduct meta-analysis for HbA1c testing among folks with depressive disorders compared to those without a diagnosis of depressive disorders. From here, you can see that the results were mixed, with the effects ranging from negative and statistically significant to positive and not statistically significant. The I-squared was incredibly high for this particular comparison. It was actually above 80%, so the odds ratio is uninterpretable. We then had enough studies to look at HbA1c testing among folks with serious mental illness. We pooled the results of three studies. Again, the I-squared was quite high, but the odds ratios, so we did not present a summary estimate. The odds ratios range from around 1 to 1.50, with a median range of 1.17. It's important to note that two of these studies were statistically significant and one was not. Next, we found five studies that assessed HbA1c testing among folks with broadly defined mental health diagnoses. Again, heterogeneity was high, so we suppressed the overall summary of effects. It's interesting to note that four of these studies displayed a negative association between the presence of mental health diagnosis and receipt of this test, and one found a positive association. Overall, the odds ratios range from 0.81 to 1.2, with the median odds ratio at 0.89. Next, we'll move on to LDL-C control. Again, we had sufficient studies to look at LDL-C control among folks with serious mental illness. We had four studies, and the summary estimate was 0.94. However, this summary estimate eclipsed one and was not statistically significant. thus, patients with an SMI diagnosis were no less likely to have LDL-C values at goal compared to diabetes patients without a diagnosis of mental illness. We also identified two additional studies that looked at LDL-C levels among folks with depressive disorders compared to those without. And these two studies found that folks with depressive disorders were no less likely to have values at goal than patients without mental illness. We also found some additional studies that looked at PTSD and broadly defined mental illness groups. For PTSD, we found one additional study that reported that folks with PTSD are no less likely to have LDL-C values at goal than patients without a diagnosis of this mental illness. And on the flip side, though, when looking at composite groups of patients with broadly defined mental illnesses, we identified two more studies. And these studies showed a positive trend that folks with broadly defined mental illnesses were more likely to have poor LDL-C, were more likely to have poor LDL-C control. Next, we'll look at diabetic eye exams. We had sufficient studies to pool the effects for eye exams among folks with depressive disorders compared to those without depressive disorders. As you can see from this figure, we had three studies, and that the summary estimate was 0.89. However, it eclipsed one, showing that there was no statistically significant difference. The I-square was moderate at almost 63%. Next, we had sufficient studies to look at mental illnesses, broadly defined groups of folks with mental illnesses in eye exams. However, heterogeneity was high across these studies. As you can see, most of the studies clustered around an association of negative patterns of having a positive having a diagnosis of mental illness and not having a receipt of an eye exam, though many of the studies clustered around one. Lastly, we found three additional SMI studies that looked at diabetic eye exams compared to those with SMI and those without SMI. Results from those studies were mixed and ranged from significant and positive to significant and negative. However, the way that those effect estimates were displayed in those studies precluded us pooling those effects. Next, let's look at the results for nephropathy screening. We had enough studies to pool the effects comparing those with SMI to those without SMI. As you can see from this forest plot, there was little variability in the point estimates, and all the estimates clustered around no effects. The odds ratios ranged from 0.96 to 1.1. We also found two additional studies that looked at depressive disorders. And these two studies showed that that folks with depressive disorders were no less likely to have this screening than patients without a diagnosis of mental illness. Next, we identified studies that looked at folks with SMI compared to those without SMI. And again, results were extremely mixed and ranged from similar rates to a positive association between SMI and this screening. So let's just distillate this down and think about what the take-home messages are for diabetes care results. The largest body of evidence that we have in this report is based off of the diabetes studies. We identified 16 individual papers that encompassed 14 individual studies. And while several of the studies addressed depressive disorders, SMI, or composite groups of diabetic patients with and without mental illness, there's relatively few studies that assess the impact of PTSD on diabetes quality of care and indicators. And much like the other preventive care outcomes that we looked at, we did have adequate studies of sufficient homogeneity, the studies that looked enough alike, to conduct upwards of 8 meta-analyses. However, most of these had really high heterogeneity, and we'll talk about that in the discussion points about why I think that there was such high heterogeneity across these studies, and I'm interested to get you all's advice on that as well. And for the most part, and across most outcomes, results were inconsistent. However, they suggested a small to modest disparities in diabetes care indicators for people with mental illness. Next, let's move on to hypertension care. And again, there was limited comparative evidence. We only found two studies, and both were within the VA. Again, we didn't have sufficient studies to conduct quantitative synthesis, but looking at qualitative synthesis, we found no significant differences in any of our outcomes of interest. For ischemic heart disease, we found even less evidence to support disparities or that there are or are not disparities. We only found one comparative study, and this study found that between adults with and without SMI, there was no difference in receipt of appropriate therapies or rates of invasive procedures post-myocardial infarction. It's interesting to note that no studies provided comparative evidence on prescription or adherence to particular therapies or blood pressure at goal outcomes that were of interest. Lastly, our second key question looked at, do effects vary by those key population characteristics and setting characteristics? And I think you all are going to see a trend here that there was limited data on the interaction effects by mental health status on key moderators. No subgroup or analysis for the subgroups of interest in the eligible studies for cancer screening, immunization, tobacco screening or referral, or for ischemic heart disease. We did identify one study with two separate published analyses that assessed mental health disparities in hypertension and diabetes process of care indicators. This study looked at geographic location, urban versus rural, race, ethnicity, black versus non-black, and found that there were no significant differences for either of these subgroups of interest. So our systematic review, while rigorous in its approach, does have limitations. We only selected certain mental health diagnoses to focus on. We focused our literature search on U.S.-only studies. We had limited studies for many of the conditions, and we only had observational studies, which, of course, are open to multiple possible forms of bias. As evidenced by our significant I-squared statistics, we had significant heterogeneity across many of our comparisons, and overall, we found a lack of data on key subgroups of interest. Overall, we feel that we found a weak signal to support disparities, but results were inconsistent. The majority of studies displayed negative associations between mental illness diagnoses and quality indicators. And most of the meta-analyses displayed high heterogeneity in the summary estimates. I contribute that high heterogeneity to a number of factors. One is the small number of studies per comparison, and differences in populations. There are significant differences in how folks who ran these studies identified those with and without mental illness versus, you know, current mental health diagnosis versus a lifetime diagnosis of mental illness. Also, there were differences in the outcome assessment of outcomes. Some were self-report versus claims. And again, there were study design issues. Of course, we looked at a minimum set of covariates that should have been controlled for, but each study controlled for a variety of covariates in the adjusted analyses. And when possible, we always took the most adjusted analysis across each paper. And in conclusion, beyond diabetes, the existing literature is sparse, and one of the reasons I was so excited to see so many researchers and policymakers on this call is that I think that this evidence review really highlights the fact that there is an opportunity for future high-quality studies, and that the VA is uniquely positioned with our excellent data to answer some of these questions and probe a little bit deeper into the existence of disparities based on mental health status. I thank you for your attention, and if you have any other questions about this review, please either call or email me. The full report and cyber seminar is available on the ESP website, and also if you have any further questions about the Office of Health Equity, please feel free to reach out to Dr. Uchendu, and this is the portal to the Office of Health Equity. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Molly to moderate questions and answers.
Great. Thank you to you both. I know a lot of our attendees joined us after the top of the hour. So to submit your question or comment, please use the question section of your GoToWebinar dashboard. To open that up, just click the plus sign next to the word questions. That'll expand the dialog box. And then you can submit your question or comment, and we'll get to it in the order that it is received. The first question: why were some mental health diagnoses excluded? For example, substance use disorders, anxiety disorders, et cetera.
That's a really excellent question. And the short answer is we looked at diagnoses that were either highly prevalent or very costly for the VA system. We would have liked to have included a very broad range of mental health diagnoses, but we promised to get these evidence syntheses completed on a 9-month time frame and with peer-reviewed reports finished by 12 months, and to include every single diagnosis under the sun, the scope would have just been too large. We're very, very happy to do other reviews that are focused on other topics, but when we, in concert with our partners and our technical expert panel, those are the set of diagnoses that we settled on that seem to be sort of the key mental health diagnoses that would point to the fact that there may or may not be disparities across the healthcare system. That being said, we compromised and looked at these broadly defined populations, and in those broadly defined studies that I've talked about, those do include a larger mix of those disorders that this person is interested in.
Thank you for that reply. This is for Dr. Chendu. What, if any, initiatives has the results of this study set for your Office of Health Equity?
Thank you for that question. We are digesting the results, and as you can see from the summary, there is need for further look at certain areas. So we have not fully aligned what those priorities are, but this, along with a couple of other studies that we have requested through the ESP, will inform policy decisions and other actions and initiatives going forward.
Thank you. Dr. Girish, I believe that you mentioned that there was less smoking cessation intervention with bipolar patients. Do you postulate that this is due to them having more severe symptoms that need to be dealt with that supersede smoking cessation?
Well, this is now getting into sort of opinion at this point. We do know that folks with mental health diagnoses, and especially folks with serious mental health diagnoses, you know, smoke are more addicted, smoke more cigarettes. And so, yes, there may be a hierarchy of need going on. But there also has been resistance to including folks like that in studies of smoking cessation interventions in the past. And so the body of literature around what's best, what are the best practices for folks who have these particular disorders, specifically SMI, is much less mature than other bodies of literature. One of the first reviews I ever did for the ESP was looking at smoking cessation interventions among folks with depression, and it was surprising how few studies were out there among folks who had current depression. In fact, if you had either current depression or depression in the, you know, depression diagnosis in the last 6 months, those folks were excluded from trials of innovative interventions. So it's a combination of things. It's a combination of there may not be sufficient evidence. It may be maybe where people seek care, and so if they're seeking care with someone who's focused on their bipolar disorder, that person may not be thinking about any of the substance abuse issues that they may also be using or coming in contact with. Excellent question. Wish I had all the answers.
Thank you for that reply. While we wait for any more questions to come in, I would like to give each of you the opportunity to give any concluding comments you'd like to. Dr. Uchendu, we appreciate you joining us. Would you like to make any final comments?
Well, I just want to say that even though there was not as much, you know, conclusions as we had hoped from this, the lack thereof opens the door for opportunity for work in the areas where we still need questions answered. And from the standpoint of internal medicine and primary care clinician myself in the VA, having come up through that to my current role, fallouts on ETRP tend to occur, at least from the primary care standpoint, on veterans who are seen in mental health and may not necessarily be fully engaged in primary care. So that was the other underlying reason behind this, to see where those areas of opportunity are if we're not, for instance, screening the mental health patients as well as we should. And obviously, some of these studies have thrown some light on it. And going back to the earlier question about priorities for my office, the intention for this was not just for priorities for the Office of Health Equity, but for anyone else who touches the various pieces. And you heard Dr. Girish mention that we had Office of Patient Care Services as well as mental health and part of the discussions on technical expert panel and so on. So the hope is that this informs and people take away from it which portions of the puzzle that they would be able to impact. Thank you.
Great, thank you. And Dr. Gerrish, would you like to wrap up with any comments?
Just building on those comments, I think it's important to note that, you know, an absence of evidence doesn't mean an absence of disparities. It just means an absence in documentation of those disparities. And I really do believe that one of the key take-home messages from this report is that there are a wealth of areas in which the VA data is uniquely positioned to help answer some of these questions and document if these important disparities exist and to what extent they exist. And in our full report, we have a table in the discussion section that lists some of the key evidence gaps and potential future research areas that we think are ripe for that VA data sets can help us answer. And I would encourage folks to look at that part of the full report and see if there's a part that you could carve out to help really move this research agenda forward, because I do believe that the VA is uniquely positioned to be a leader, already is a leader in this field, and is uniquely positioned to continue in that leadership role and fill some of those important evidence gaps in future research.
Excellent. Well, I'd like to thank you both very much for joining us today and for lending your expertise to the field, and of course to our attendees for joining us. As I mentioned earlier, when I close the session, a feedback survey will pop up on your screen. Please take just a moment to fill out those questions. We do look very closely at the responses, and it helps us to improve sessions we've already done as well as add new sessions to our schedule. If you have any suggestions for ESP topics, feel free to include them in the survey, or you can always fill out the form on the HSR&D ESP website. So thank you once again to our audience and to our presenters, and this does conclude today's HSR&D Cyber Seminar presentation.